Think back to a time when you felt just completely, entirely emotionally drained.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't mean the kind of tired you feel after like working a 50-hour week or moving apartments. I am talking about being exhausted from the sheer act of caring too much.
Right, that heavy, bone-deep exhaustion. It feels like an emotional flatlining.
Exactly. You know that feeling where you're the friend everyone calls for advice, or you've been managing this massive crisis at work and suddenly you just hit a wall. You literally cannot muster another ounce of empathy.
We are taught to view empathy as this ultimate superpower, you know. But in reality, when it is heavily relied upon day after day, it becomes an incredible vulnerability.
Well, welcome to today's deep dive. We are looking at a stack of sources today that gets deeply into the mechanics of that exact feeling.
And it is a fascinating stack.
It really is. On the desk, we have this comprehensive, heavily researched textbook by Dr. Charles Figley and Dr. Robert Roop. It focuses on the psychological toll of animal care. To pair with that, we've pulled clinical studies from Drexel University on art therapy and stress hormones, plus an insightful piece from the Wall Street Journal on the rise of what they call slowcations.
Yeah, the slowcations are such an interesting concept.
Right. And some fascinating brochures for restorative retreats designed specifically for professionals who have hit that absolute empathetic wall.
It is a remarkable intersection, I mean, of clinical psychology, neurobiology, and these emerging travel trends. And while our primary lens for this discussion is the veterinary and animal rescue world.
Mostly because these professionals serve as like the canaries in the coal mine for this specific type of stress.
Exactly. But the insights we are pulling from these sources, they really apply to anyone who relies on empathy to do their job or even just to live their life.
So, our mission for this deep dive is to unpack the critical difference between simply being burned out and suffering from what they call compassion fatigue. We want to look under the hood to understand the actual neurobiology of why empathy hurts so much.
And then, you know, explore this surprising, highly creative ways people are actually healing their brains and reclaiming their lives.
Let's jump into it. Let's start by defining our terms, because I feel like people tend to throw the word burnout around as a catch-all for any kind of work-related stress.
Oh, constantly. But Figley and Roop make a very sharp, necessary distinction between burnout and compassion fatigue. Burnout is fundamentally an organizational issue.
Meaning it's about the logistics of the job itself.
Yes, exactly. It is the result of carrying too heavy a workload or lacking control over your schedule.
Or toxic management, right.
Right. Or constantly fighting with clients over fees. It builds up gradually. Basically, your environment is simply demanding more resources than you have to give.
So burnout is essentially being fed up with your workplace. But compassion fatigue, according to the textbook, operates on a completely different level.
A profoundly different level.
They define it as a form of secondary traumatic stress. It is caused by the very act of empathizing with suffering. It's the trauma of caring.
Because to be effective in a helping profession, you have to connect. You have to actively project yourself into the suffering of the patient or the client to understand what they need.
Right.
But by intentionally opening that emotional door, you allow their trauma to step inside and literally become your trauma.
I was trying to visualize this while reading the sources, and I think I found a way to separate the two. Burnout is like a smartphone running out of battery.
Okay, I like that.
You just need to plug it in, step away for a long weekend, let it recharge.
Right.
But compassion fatigue is more like the phone's hardware getting corrupted because you downloaded too many massive virus-laden files.
Yes.
A weekend nap does not fix a corrupted hard drive.
That analogy perfectly captures the severity of the issue. And in the veterinary and animal shelter world, that internal hardware is under constant, relentless assault. Figley and Roop dedicate a significant portion of their research to something called the care-killing paradox.
Yeah, reading about this paradox was incredibly heavy.
It really is.
These workers enter the veterinary profession because they have a profound love for animals. Their entire goal is to heal. But because of systemic issues like overpopulation, a chronic lack of funding, or severe untreatable illnesses,
Right.
these same compassionate workers frequently have to perform euthanasia on the very animals they are desperately trying to save.
It creates a profound psychological conflict.
I mean, anyone who has ever had to put a beloved family pet down knows that it is one of the worst, most gut-wrenching days of your life.
Absolutely.
Now imagine having to do that three times before your lunch break to animals you have been fighting for weeks to save. It is almost unthinkable to carry that weight daily.
And because the human brain cannot casually process that level of paradox, it develops defense mechanisms just to survive the shift. The sources outline two major psychological shields that caregivers unconsciously put up. The first is anthropomorphism,
which is where workers project human traits onto the animals.
Exactly. They start treating a sick puppy with the same emotional weight as a human baby.
Which seems like it would just make the inevitable loss infinitely harder to bear. If you view the animal as a human infant, losing it must be devastating.
It is. It magnifies the grief exponentially. And that leads to the second defense mechanism, which is misanthropy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. These workers are constantly exposed to animals that have been neglected, abandoned, or actively abused by humans. Over time, the caregivers can develop a deep, pervasive mistrust and dislike of people in general.
They start hating humanity because of what humanity does to the animals they love. I mean, it makes sense. The textbook actually maps out the trajectory of a helper's career, breaking it down into five distinct phases.
The phases are so eye-opening. Everyone starts at phase one, the dream. You graduate, you get your first job, and you are going to save the world.
Right. Then comes phase two, the start. You're thrown into the deep end, running on pure adrenaline and idealism.
But the adrenaline always runs out. That brings us to phase three, which they call losing our breath. This is where the bubble bursts. The daily trauma piles up, the defense mechanisms kick in, and that bone-deep fatigue settles over you.
And that naturally slides into phase four, right? Desperately seeking rhythm.
Yes, you are flailing, trying to find any coping mechanism to survive the emotional onslaught without quitting.
And finally, if you don't leave the profession entirely, you reach phase five, finding our rhythm. You accept that profound pain is simply part of the job, and you learn to manage it.
And that's the ultimate goal, yeah.
But looking at this entire brutal cycle, I kept asking myself a very basic question. If this work causes such immense psychological pain, why on earth do these professionals keep coming back?
Well, the answer lies in a concept called compassion satisfaction. It is the counterweight to the fatigue. It's that intense joy, the profound sense of purpose, and the redemptive feeling a worker gets from successfully healing an animal and seeing the relief wash over a thankful client.
So it's like a scale. You have the crippling fatigue on one side and the intense satisfaction on the other.
The goal for these workers isn't to stop caring. Because if you numb yourself entirely, you can't do the job the year. You lose the ability to diagnose and comfort.
Right. You'd be useless as a caregiver.
Exactly. The goal is to actively balance the compassion fatigue with compassion satisfaction so you can actually survive the calling.
But why does that scale tip so easily toward fatigue? To understand that, we have to look under the hood at the actual neurobiology. What is empathy actually doing to our brain's wiring?
The biological response is staggering. When a caregiver is exposed to trauma, say, an animal dying in their arms while a family is crying in the exam room, the brain registers that environment as an immediate physical threat.
Really? Like a physical danger?
Yes. It triggers the release of glucocorticoids.
I know those are stress hormones, but what are they actually doing in that moment?
They are the body's emergency override system, designed to mobilize energy for a fight or flight response. They shut down non-essential functions, like digestion, and flood your muscles with glucose so you can react to danger.
Wow.
In the short term, say for 20 minutes, they keep you incredibly alert. But chronic daily exposure to high levels of glucocorticoids is highly toxic to the brain. The research indicates that prolonged exposure can actually lead to a physical reduction in the volume of the hippocampus.
Wait, the hippocampus? That's the brain center for memory and emotional regulation. So the act of caring too much over a long enough timeline literally shrinks your brain's ability to process emotions.
Yes, it degrades the neuronal pathways.
Yeah.
And the mechanics of how the brain processes trauma makes this even more complicated. Mm-hmm. You have the left hemisphere of your brain, which is your logical, verbal, and analytical filing cabinet. Then you have the right hemisphere, which is emotional, intuitive, and nonverbal. It's where you experience the raw feeling of the trauma.
And connecting those two halves is the corpus callosum. It acts like a bridge.
Exactly. Under normal circumstances, that bridge handles the traffic beautifully. You experience something emotional on the right, it crosses the bridge to the left, and you verbalize it and file it away.
Makes sense.
But under severe, repeated distress, that gateway gets jammed. The logical left brain simply cannot process the massive, chaotic influx of emotional data coming from the right brain. The bridge breaks down and you get stuck in a state of unresolvable stress.
And because you feel stuck and overwhelmed, you naturally seek out help from the people around you, which brings us to the concept of systemic traumatology mentioned in the sources.
Yes, the contagion effect.
I was looking at this diagram explaining the contagious nature of compassion fatigue, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. If I have a terrible, emotionally draining day and I go to the break room to vent to a coworker, I'm not just letting off steam, I am literally infecting them with my trauma.
You are. The sources are very clear on this self-regenerating loop. When person A is overwhelmed and seeks relief by pouring their heart out to person B absorbs that trauma.
Oh, wow.
Because person B is also an empathetic caregiver, they open that emotional door and your corrupted files transfer right to their hard drive.
I feel a retroactive wave of guilt for every time I've ever complained about my day in a break room.
Well, it's a completely natural human instinct to seek connection when we hurt. But the danger lies in how the brain prioritizes information. Negative emotions and situations hold our attention 5 times longer than positive ones.
5 times longer? That is wild.
So if a caregiving organization doesn't have a structured clinical way to process trauma, and the staff relies on constantly venting to each other between appointments, the entire workplace quickly becomes emotionally toxic. The infection spreads until everyone's empathy battery is dead.
So if talking it out with coworkers just spreads the infection, and our logical left brain is too jammed up to process the trauma rationally anyway, what do we do? How do we fix the corrupted hardware without talking about it?
The research points in a very specific and perhaps surprising direction. To heal a jammed nervous system, you have to bypass your logical, verbal brain entirely. You have to use your hands.
Which brings us to the Happy Vet Project article. They emphasize the absolute necessity of finding a hobby completely outside of your profession, things like sports, baking, or painting.
Right.
The obvious benefit is that these activities boost endorphins and serotonin. But the real neurobiological magic is that it forces the brain to stop ruminating on clinical cases.
It engages that nonverbal right hemisphere and gives the overwhelmed left hemisphere a much-needed break. And this isn't just a lifestyle theory. Drexel University put this exact concept to the test in a clinical setting.
Right. And place them in a room for 45 minutes of unstructured art making. We're talking clay, markers, collage materials, no instructions, no grading, just a directive to create whatever they wanted.
And the researchers measured their cortisol levels, a major stress hormone heavily involved in the fight or flight response both before and after the 45-minute session.
And the overarching results were fantastic. Like 75% of the participants saw a significant reduction in cortisol. And the detail I loved most is that prior artistic experience didn't matter at all.
No, not at all.
You could be a master sculptor or someone who struggles to draw a stick figure, and your brain still reaped the stress relief benefits. The younger participants actually showed the most consistent drops in cortisol across the board.
It demonstrates that the simple, tactile act of creating is fundamentally regulating for the human nervous system.
I have to admit, though, when I was reading through the Drexel study, I zeroed in on that remaining 25%.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because honestly, if you put a lump of clay in front of me and say, make art, I am going to panic. I'm going to stress out about whether it looks good or if I'm doing it right. If 75% lowered their cortisol, that means 25% of the people had their stress hormones go up after making art. Is that what was happening to them? Did trying to sculpt a clay bowl actually stress them out more?
It is so easy to look at a hormone like cortisol as the ultimate enemy, but the mechanics of how it works in our bodies are far more nuanced. Cortisol isn't strictly a bad chemical.
Right.
We needed to wake up in the morning. We needed to focus, to function, and to solve problems.
So the spike in that 25% wasn't a panic attack over a bad drawing.
Not at all. Camel explained that higher cortisol levels in that specific group indicated a state of healthy arousal and engagement. They were energized. They were in a state of flow, actively problem solving with the clay, or figuring out how to balance a collage.
Oh, I see.
It proves the brain was being stimulated in a healthy, creative way, rather than looping endlessly on traumatic memories.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. They were engaged, not terrified. So, building a habit of doing 45 minutes of unstructured art is a fantastic way to keep the daily hardware running smoothly. But what happens when a professional is so deeply entrenched in phase four desperately seeking rhythm that 45 minutes of clay just isn't going to cut it? What if they need a total system reboot?
That is where we are seeing the travel and wellness industry step in, offering a completely new paradigm for how we approach recovery.
Yeah. The Wall Street Journal article dives into the rise of something called the Slowcation. These are craft-focused, deeply immersive retreats specifically designed for overworked professionals. And apparently, they are massively popular with solo women travelers looking to disconnect.
They are the absolute antithesis of the traditional, exhausting tourist vacation where you rush from landmark to landmark and end up needing a vacation to recover from your vacation.
The sensory details in the WSJ piece really highlight why these work. Instead of staring at a glaring clinic screen, guests at Emily Avinson's Floripian retreat in Belgium are walking out into a chateau garden in their pajamas to pick rhubarb and custard dahlias.
Or you have Lotta Jansdotter hosting block printing workshops on a private 40-acre island in Finland.
Wow.
It's entirely tactile. You are working with your hands, eating traditional fish soup, taking saunas, and completely resetting your nervous system.
There's also Jen Buchel, a Silicon Valley tech advisor who completely changed her life trajectory after taking a weaving journey in Puglia, Italy with Ace Camps. These trips aren't about sightseeing. They are about tuning out the chaotic noise and using your hands to rebuild your inner peace.
And we are seeing this exact concept migrate directly into the medical and veterinary fields. The industry is waking up to the crisis and literally prescribing highly structured vacations to save their workers' lives.
The prime example in our sources is the Wild Sun Rescue Retreats down in Costa Rica. These just took place in February and March of this year, 2026. They brought veterinary professionals out of their sterile, high-stress clinics and into the jungle.
And the brilliant part is how they structured it.
Yes. The brilliant part is that attendees earned their mandatory continuing education credits, their RACI credits, while they were there. But the lectures were combined with guided waterfall hikes, nighttime tours of bioluminescent bays, and hands-on conservation work with endangered spider monkeys.
It's a brilliant structural solution to a systemic problem.
It's like sneaking vegetables into the mac and cheese. These professionals think they're just fulfilling their mandatory educational requirements to keep their licenses active, but they're actually being tripped into getting the psychological healing and nervous system regulation they desperately need but would never book for themselves.
Exactly. Look at how the Veterinary Compassion Project is scaling this idea for their upcoming Restorative Retreat 2026, happening next month, April 24th to the 26th.
Right, at the historic Hotel Petaluma in California's wine country.
The programming is entirely focused on survival. It's led by Dr. Aaron Holder and features clinical social workers. They are running sessions on somatic healing, which is the practice of actually moving trapped trauma out of the physical body through movement and breath and heart coherence.
Wait, heart coherence? Is that like syncing your heartbeat to your breathing?
Essentially, yes. It is a scientifically validated technique where you align your breathing with your heart rate variability. It sends a direct physical signal to the brain that you are safe, which shuts off that toxic flow of glucocorticoids we talked about earlier.
That is incredible.
They're also teaching strict boundary setting to protect that newly found peace.
I noticed they're also hosting an exclusive screening of the documentary Rescued Hearts with the filmmakers during the retreat. It seems like a huge part of this is just breaking the isolation of the job.
Emmett Fitzgerald is quoted in the Petaluma retreat materials, and he captures the core issue perfectly. He says empathy is a finite resource.
A finite resource.
You can run out. These immersive environments break that toxic, contagious cycle of isolation we discussed in the break room scenario. They rebuild a healthy community, and most importantly, they restore that vital compassion satisfaction.
Because if you don't restore the satisfaction, you are just left with the fatigue, and you cannot survive the calling.
You have to physically step away from the trauma to remember why you wanted to heal in the first place.
So let's look at the incredible journey we've taken through these sources today. We started by defining the profound difference between ordinary organizational burnout and the actual neurobiological damage caused by compassion fatigue. We learned that the trauma of caring too much can flood our bodies with stress hormones, shrink the hippocampus, and jam the brain's communication pathways.
We also uncovered the dangerous reality that untreated compassion fatigue operates like a virus. It is highly contagious in the workplace if we rely only on venting to process our pain.
But there is a scientifically proven path forward. We saw the cortisol-lowering power of getting out of our logical heads and using our hands, whether that means committing to 45 minutes of unstructured clay sculpting or flying across the world for a week-long slowcation in a Belgian chateau or a Costa Rican jungle.
The clinical takeaway is undeniable. You know, we have to actively and intentionally protect our nervous systems.
To you listening right now, whether you are a veterinarian, a nurse, a manager, or simply the friend that everyone constantly relies on for emotional support, your personal empathy battery has a limit. Your hardware can get corrupted. Find a tactile hobby. Get your hands dirty. Protect your peace.
It is not a luxury to care for yourself. It is a fundamental clinical necessity.
I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over today. Empathy is the invisible glue that holds human society together. Without it, everything falls apart. Yet we constantly treat it as an infinite free resource that we can just tap into whenever we want. Imagine how our world would change if our professional cultures stopped treating emotional maintenance as an indulgent luxury vacation and started treating it like a mandatory software update, an absolute non-negotiable requirement to keep the human system running. Empathy might be what makes us human, but it takes actual intentional work to keep that well from running dry.